there a doctor in the house?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
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 And doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
All right, Dr. Batar, we do have some stuff to cover going advanced medicine. In fact, I think who in our audience needs the most help? The doctors.
Doctors, yeah.
The doctors, yeah. You know it. And this article that we opened with up today, and by the way, we'll flex with this one, but I was just so fascinated. And we were talking briefly before we went on the air about it. You also keyed into this and said, whoa, this is an interesting article. It's about the five biggest fears doctors confess, not to the public, but to other doctors. I'm like, do you guys get together and talk about your fears, Dr. Batar?
You know, it's interesting. I will tell you that if there's, I don't know about getting together and talking about your fears, but I have noticed that when you have two doctors talking in private, as long as it's myself and another doctor, no matter who I'm talking with, the subject always revolves around one certain general concept. As soon as you bring a third doctor into the picture, it'll usually start to change. The subject matter will change. You bring four into it, it automatically definitely becomes different. But if it's just two people talking, it's always something about money. Okay, it's about either their investments or about insurance claims or about how difficult it is to practice, or all financial type concerns. And once you've got four or five doctors together, they usually don't talk about that stuff. They're talking about medical stuff, patient stuff.
Sure, but the it seems like when you get, as you said, a one-on-one, you're like just talking, just you and me, it goes to economics. Now, I'm not going to necessarily say that's a bad thing per se, but it does beg the question, Dr. Batar. You know, to go in the Western world, allopathic medicine in the United States, at least when we were growing up, you know, if you got to be a medical doctor, you were going to be at the higher end of the percentages in terms of economics, right? And so I come back to my uncle, the doctor, a physician who warned me not to become a doctor for a number of reasons, one of which was probably related to economics, but more or less the joy that he felt becoming a doctor and the misery he felt being a doctor because of what the government did by infusing itself and corrupting what he thought he was going to do as a physician, right? So when you get into that, now we see that doctors, I've got buddies that I've talked with one-on-one, me, the homeopath, them, the medical doctor, and they we'll talk economics too. So I agree, that's a one-on-one, that's typically where it goes.
And you're right, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just an interesting observation that the conversation revolving around economical issues, and it has become, from a financial standpoint, it has become more difficult to practice medicine because remuneration from insurance companies goes lower and lower. They're always trying to beat the doctors up. There's a cost that people don't understand of practicing medicine, especially for doctors like me because of the fights that we have to deal with the medical board. I mean, the amount of wastage of economic
time, money, resources.
The economic wastage is just absolutely atrocious. All that could be applied towards other things that are so much more productive and so much more beneficial for people. But you know, remuneration going down, doctors feeling slighted, doctors trying to struggle financially, taking care of employees. You know, benefits, this, that, the other. It's just like any other business. But the point is that. That's what I've seen, at least when two people think that's their biggest concern.
And it's called peniaphobia. Peniaphobia. No, it has nothing to do with their nether regions. That, not at all. But that's what it's called. The fear of being poor. Now, I don't know how to determine, you know, what is the percentage of people that go into med school because of economic reasons? Say, you know what, I really want to be rich. I want to be a doctor. Because there are way better ways to get rich. In fact, it's very difficult to become rich as a doctor today, going in with what's happening.
It's impossible today. Yeah.
So number one on their fears is the fear of being poor, which, you know, unfortunately, again, they've entered into a system that is now so corrupted and infused with waste, as you said, even fraud as government has come in and different people taking chunks of the pie through government agencies, the capturing of regulatory agencies, any number of things that have made it not what it once was when, again, there might have been a higher ideal there. Number two on the list, this was interesting to me. I can't even say, metathesiophobia, the fear of change. The fear of change.
Yeah. So, Robert, I had not looked at this list. I just saw the article and I thought it was interesting. So I'm actually surprised that my observation coincided with the number one, which was the fear of being poor. I didn't know that. I just thought you were bringing that up.
No, you were nailing it. But I figured, because this is experience as a physician, you know what you're going to talk to your buddies about, or maybe just acquaintances, as you said, one-on-one. As it gets to a larger group, it may not go that way unless you're in a seminar about economics together. But to number two, the thing about change, it says, for all the talk about cost containment, the healthcare industry is not and has never been known for optimal efficiency.
Absolutely not. This is one reason that they're so vested in the status quo that, and of course, I think that's because they have so much to lose. If they lose their control, their grip on the status quo, then basically they are now obsolete because they're practicing the medicine of yesterday and day before yesterday. It's not what's happening in the future, right? So that fear of change is actually something that stems from the hierarchy down into the individual physicians. They like the same mediocrity, okay? They're okay. They want to stay within that standard of care. I mean, do you know any industry that talks about a standard of care? That stay within the standard? I would think that everybody would want to excel and exceed it, the standard, but this is what they want to be. They want to be in the standard. It's like considered a safe place to be inside that box, not outside the box, because outside the box is risky. It's change. It's unknown. We don't want to be there. So,
it makes excellence
sense because the hierarchy promotes that.
Excellence or mediocrity? Mediocrity means no change. You just got to do the same thing. And how many stories have we covered over the years where peer-reviewed articles come out and say, you know what, that whole thing doctors have been doing for generations, the original study was not right. And then despite knowing that, the physicians don't change. They don't, no, I'm still going to do it. So you're right. The fear of change is another big one there.
And in fact, you see this right now with the vaccine issue. You see this with the cancer issue, with chemo radiation. You see this with pretty much all the pharmaceutical models, in fact, the same class of drugs. They have a new drug that'll come out, but it's basically the same class. You know, it's got a little spin on it here, a little spin on it there. But it's all the same stuff. It's a regurgitation of the same old stuff. It's all palliative. It's just maintenance. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about actually making a significant change. Anything that's significant that's changing for the benefit, it's happening in restorative or that type of medicine, you know, surgical type innovations, and or it's happening in the cutting edge, like stem cells and that type of stuff. It's nothing to do with that normal, everyday taking care of the cardiovascular disease, cancer.
Right, right. They're still practicing 20, 30 or more years behind. That's true. Number three on the list, politicophobia. That's easy. The fear of politics. They're saying like half of the doctors are afraid that, you know, Republicans will wipe out insurance. The other half are afraid that the Democrats will make it socialized, right? Where is the freedom in this concept? Again, I guess this maybe reflects the political, the body politic in general doctors do. That imagine if there were no insurance and that doctors had to respond one-on-one to their patients and the patients were billed, you know, directly. You might not make as much money, but wouldn't there be a lot of joy in seeing people get well?
You would think so. You would think that there would be a tremendous amount of personal satisfaction of just making the. I mean, for me personally, that's the number one thing. I guess because they're not getting those type of results, they don't have that personal satisfaction because they're again practicing within that mediocrity level, and so they're not getting anything extraordinary, any kind of extraordinary results. And sure, they may get some personal satisfaction from some average responses that they get from here or there, but they're not getting the life-changing impact. You know, you saved my life, you did this. Unless they're, of course, in a surgical or trauma-type field or emergency medicine field. Otherwise, it's just the same blah, 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 the same blasé thing.
Mm-hmm. And then we have another one on the list here. Gets, you know, I think this whole article is interesting. Hypengaiophobia? I've never said that. The fear of being blamed. Are they afraid of being blamed for something happening that goes wrong?
Well, I think that if you're, again, practicing within that mediocrity, you've probably got a guilty conscience because you know that there's other things you can do. And so, you know, it's CYA type medicine, you know, cover your ass type medicine. I don't know if I can say that, but I just
can say that.
Okay, yeah, so it's that type of a thing. So it would make sense why that they're motivated by fear. And I've always said that, you know, most people are motivated by fear on this planet, but especially medicine, especially doctors, they are so motivated by fear. They are never motivated, very rarely are they motivated by love. The profession itself is motivated by fear. I mean, you know, you've got the fear of the medical board, you got the fear of the governmental agencies, you got the fear of the FDA, of using a drug off label, you got the fear of insurance companies, you got fear of the patients suing you, you got fear of the professional societies, you know, coming down on you. You got fear of everything. You got fear of other doctors, your peer group, you know, thinking that you're doing something wrong.
Sure.
You're just riddled with fear.
Another story, I think over the years, a few times we've covered it here on Advanced Medicine, Dr. Bitar, that when doctors would actually confront patients to acknowledge that they screwed up, they're less likely to be sued. The acknowledgement that, my gosh, I'm human, and rather than staying above the fray and don't admit any guilt, and of course, then it raises the contentions higher.
Without a doubt, that's a very true statement.
The last fear on this list, Dr. Bitar, I know we've got to race through it just to get through the segment here, the fear of failure. I think that's, I don't know, maybe that's a human thing beyond doctors, but number five on this list was fear of failure.
Yeah, that's probably, Robert, I would probably say that's probably with most professions, fear of failure, though, don't you think?
Yeah, I don't think that's unique to the medical. It just happened to be number five on this list. Of course, how do we define failure? That's interesting. Does it go back to number one on their fear list, economics? Or does it go to, my gosh, I'm not helping my patients, I'm failing my patients? And if they don't have a definition of what it means to heal because they don't, they suppress, then I don't know how they equate failure and success.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that this is one of the things that, you know, what is the definition of failure, too? Because I think as long as you tried and you never quit, then you really didn't fail. But a lot of people, they never even try. And so that they have that sense of failure, but there was no ever way for them to ever succeed it because they never even tried. You have to first attempt something before you can succeed at it. So.
And if any of these five fears are not being resolved, of course, it's leading to modern medicine doctors being one of the leading professions in terms of depression, burnout, and suicide. So compassion to them as humans, and we would offer them help. Just keep listening to the Robert Scott Bell Show, Advanced Medicine with Dr. Rasha Bitar. We'll be back after this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
In all my years of radio, I've never seen anything like this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Robert Scott Bell Show.
Each week at this time of the week, we are going Advanced Medicine with Dr. Rasha Bitar. He's the author of the international best-selling book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. We'll get into an upcoming webinar that you'll want to participate in, how to do that a little bit later, so stick with us. But right now, I want to talk about dentistry. Dentistry, you know, I've talked about pediatricians being very dangerous. But dentists can be really dangerous. They're embracing of mercury, root canals, on and on and on. Really rough. But one of the things they do, and you talked about fear-based medicine, CYA medicine. And I understand why they do it. I'm not saying I support it. But like if you're going in for a procedure, sometimes even teeth cleaning, these dentists will say, you're going to go on an antibiotic prophylactically. Now, in this one case we have here, this guy was going in for a root canal procedure. They put him on an antibiotic. He ended up with meningitis. I'm not saying that happens every time, but back up for a minute, and Dr. Bitar, help us understand why they want people on antibiotics prophylactically.
Well, the whole idea is prophylaxis is to prevent an individual from getting an exposure to a bacteria that during the procedure, like a dental procedure or some other procedure where there's a higher risk for them to develop an iatrogenic type infection. When I mean when I say iatrogenic, I'm talking about from a doctor-induced procedure or something that would increase the risk of them developing susceptibility to get an infection. So the whole idea is, for example, the reason we do antibiotics before a dental procedure is because, as you know, Robert, you probably covered this on the show before, 95% of all disease starts in the mouth. But more so than that, if there's a bacterial infection, infects the gingiva or somewhere in the mouth or in the dental component, what happens is that those infections, if there's a heart valve transplant or there's some type of a cardiac prosthesis, a pacemaker or something, or even if somebody doesn't have something like that, there's a higher chance of the bacteria that starts in the mouth or is seeded from the mouth gets deposited within the heart tissue and causes something called endocarditis, which is basically a non-descriptive description of inflammation of the heart tissue. So that's an example of wanting to do prophylactic antibiotic treatment in order to prevent somebody from getting an infection. Or if somebody has a prosthesis, they have an artificial knee, artificial hip.
Well, but do they take an individual into consideration to say you're likely at risk, or you know, a general public not necessarily, or most not, but they tend to do a one size fits all, again, CYA type medicine.
Yes. Yeah. It's the CYA one size fits all. They don't look at the person's necessary history. They'll say that if it's good for somebody with a prosthesis or a cardiac condition, it's probably good for everybody. Which you and I know that that's not the case, but that's how it's done.
That's mediocre medicine. That's what we're talking about here, standard of care. And in this case, this guy got amoxicillin and ended up with a meningitis response from the amoxicillin, not from an infection. So there is a potential that the antibiotic might not save your life, but might end it.
Yeah, now I don't know. I didn't read this article, so I can't really comment on it. It's hard to get an infection from the use of an antibiotic unless it causes such a significant dissemination of the good bacteria counts and then causes for an opportunistic type secondary response. Like, you know, you would expect to see, say, there's certain types of gastrointestinal bacterial flora that can actually grow too much because the good flora has been
wiped out.
Clostridium difficile, for example, or systemic candidiasis, a yeast type infection. So I'm not really sure because I didn't read this, but maybe you can fill me in on it.
No, they're saying it's a rare effect. It's not unprecedented, but it's very rare. So we're not saying everybody's going to get this, but to be fully informed, you should know that, you know, some people can react to this amoxicillin with it. I don't know if they call it an allergy in this, but it's definitely an adverse event with a meningitis, much less the cause. They say the drug is actually causing it. They're not claiming a bacteria did it in this case. But I would argue that we know of other options, like, for instance, silver intravenously or otherwise, that could preclude the need for disruptive antibiotic therapy, even prophylactically, but not enough folks know about it.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. You know, so there's certain things that a person should be very cognizant of. Obviously, washing your hands is just a general thing that we've talked about. Before washing your hands, making sure that you practice make sure you practice things that would prevent you from getting some type of an unnecessary exposure. I'll give you a perfect example. Some certain cultures, they don't walk with shoes inside the house. That's a thing that I personally believe that you shouldn't do that. But then using natural things like the echinaceas and the selenium and the silver and some of these other things, very important things for people to be aware of.
All right, folks, we got a lot more advanced medicine to go. We're going to tell you about an upcoming webinar we want you to participate with. If you haven't signed up, we'll tell you how to do it, how to become a member of the group to get you out of the public domain to learn the things you need to know to get well and stay well.
You're listening to The Robert Scott Bell Show. The Robert Scott Bell Show. The Robert Scott Bell Show.
All right, Advanced Medicine is on halfway through, and Dr. Bitar, you can find him at advancedmedicine.com, drbitar.com. In fact, advancedmedicine.com is where I want you to go, and it's linked up in the show notes at robertscottbell.com, because there's an upcoming online webinar. You get to learn stuff we can't even say on the radio. Not kidding, not exaggerating for effect. This is not anything but it's straight up the truth. We can't say certain things on the radio. So you want to participate? You go to advancedmedicine.com. You'll see a link there for the IADFW. And this is a private association that you can participate, you can join, that takes you out of the public domain, but you have to have an invitation code. You're listening to the Robert Scott Bell Show. It's 1358, 1358. That gets you in. Then you get your own code you could share, too, and bring more people in to learn about the things you're going to learn about that'll empower you with health and healing outside of the public domain. Have I said that well enough there, Dr. Bitar?
You have said that perfectly, and for any somebody to join, it's completely free to join Advanced Medicine and have access to the headmap and all that. To become a member of the IADFW, it's $99 a year, but with an invitation code. If you've been invited by somebody, it's only a dollar, and it's for a lifetime. So the code that Robert just gave you, 1358, right, Robert? That's your invitation code?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so just use that. You can join, and then you get immediately you'll have your own invitation code on the upper right. So I've actually had some people that have told people to come and join, and they've used my invitation code. Don't use mine. You know, if you joined, don't use Robert's or mine.
Use yours.
Use your own.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, yeah, it's going to be really, really great. This is our first IADFW webinar. We've got five webinars in 5 months, and we're going to be releasing some pretty incredible information. So,
yeah, and it's going to be the 11th of October, so it's coming up pretty quick.
Yes, October 11th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And we've already got beyond our the number of people that we can seat. We've already got everybody can be able to view it, but as far as participate, there's only so many spots, and those spots we're already beyond that registration point. But you'll still be able to tune in and watch the stuff. So please register. The only way you'll be able to see it is if you register.
All right. Beautiful. All right. So y'all check it out, and there'll be some great tools you're going to learn about, be able to implement immediately into your life for the better. Now, we have some more unfortunate news about the vaccinations. Now, we're not crying a river over the loss of faith in vaccinations because we don't believe in having faith in something that should be scientifically validated. You don't need faith if it's really been validated. It's like, well, you know, we show you it works every time, here's the evidence, right? But they don't have that with vaccination. No double-blind placebo-controlled studies. Now, this HPV shot, Dr. Bitar, they recently, the FDA just a few days ago, I think, approved it to be expanded. They're calling it the Gardasil 9. It's like the Gardasil shot on steroids for more whatever, and they're now going to give it to 27 to 45-year-olds, right? The first story was we got to get 8, 9, 10-year-olds before they become sexually active with the HPV because it'll prevent the cervical cancer, which they've never provided proof that the HPV actually causes it, nor can the vaccine prevent it. That didn't matter to the FDA. Now, in Japan, when that happens, they go, we're not mandating this. We're pulling it off the market. In America, they go, hey, no, let's expand the market because not enough of you young kids are getting it. Your parents are on to us. Now, there are two more disaster stories of preteens. This happened recently, although it was reported recently. Two teens, after getting the HPV shot, developed multiple sclerosis, MS, a boy and a girl. MS in teenagers. Dr. Bitar, after this aluminum-containing vaccine was given.
And this is not an isolated incident. There's a lot of people that are getting injured, like Robert. You know that.
Oh, big time. And the thing that's unique about this is at neurologyadvisor.com. This is not an alternative website. This is not natural news. This is coming from an insider group within medicine. Really concerned about brain and neurological health. A 14-year-old male and a 17-year-old female both developed a demyelinating disease after the administration of the HPV vaccine.
Yeah, it's really, really sad. And I think more and more people are becoming aware of it. I think it's going to become as volatile of an issue. It's taken more time, but I think it's going to become as volatile of an issue as this Kavanaugh confirmation, Robert. I think as more people get to this point, and there's going to be a lot of anger, and there may be actually, believe it or not, some bipartisan support in this component. I don't know whether there would be or not, but that NIH Director's Pioneer Award that I was nominated for, apparently I was the first person that had the bipartisan nomination. I had Democrat Congress Lady Diane Watson from California, and then our friend Dan Burton from Indiana, Republican, they both joined together and nominated me for that National Institute of Health Director's Pioneer Award. So there is a bipartisan component when it comes to vaccine injury. But I really think that there's a potential for that to escalate into a truly, truly volatile national issue. We still then probably become an international issue because it's affecting everybody in every country. I hear about it every place I go. I mean, I was in Singapore, I was in New Zealand, I was in Australia, I was in Jordan, I was in Israel and Palestine, all this year. So far in Rome twice, every country that I was in this year, same issue, vaccine issue. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's talking about it. And they're very heated. Those that are pro, those that are against. You know, very, very heated. So I think it's got a big potential for causing the next major international.
It can no longer be contained, is the point. No. You're saying there's too many people that have been impacted. Too many people, even that are pro-vaccine, have to acknowledge when it happens to them or their family member, their kid, their grandkid, their niece, their nephew. And that's the point where I don't know what their long-range plan is. I know what their goal is. But how do they mitigate the fact that too many people have bore witness to the untoward effects of these vaccinations, leading into, you know, autism, death, or in this case, MS, other neurological manifestations?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that if I had my choice, I would like to start changing the word. Instead of pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine, I think it should be pro-vaccine and anti-stupidity. That's my campaign. I would want to change the word that we use to describe this. You know, pro-vaccine and anti-stupidity. That's where I'd like to go.
Yeah, I know. It's not politically correct to use that such language, but we don't stop on that here. We've got to speak straight about this because many in our audience, and you know, you've helped so many thousands of families directly and indirectly over the years because of what happened initially to your son after a vaccine and what you did and the promise you made to God, you know, in the recovery process and how that changed your life, changed the mission of your life. And many people have experienced similar things and have their lives have changed remarkably. And you'd think the disaster would be all a disaster, but in some ways, somebody and a lot of somebodies now have to wake up and start yelling out to the world, this is real, this is happening, this has happened. And again, it can't be contained anymore.
You know, talk about how truth, how truth is stranger than fiction. Abby was with me a couple of days ago, and he told me, he goes, Dad, you know, we had this debate that we were assigned to two different positions that we had to argue in one of his debate classes. And it was interesting because the position that he got, it was about vaccines, about vaccine safety, and he got assigned to the group that was pro-vaccine, right? So he had to make the arguments. He said, oh, that's interesting. So he was actually telling his group the position of the anti-vaccine so they could actually prepare for the debate. And I asked him, I said, how was the other side? And he said, well, you know, they had some interesting points, but he goes, it was just an assignment for them, you could tell, but they weren't really animated like he wanted to be. But he said it was interesting for him to take the pro-vaccine side because that was the assignment. I said, you couldn't have switched your assignment. He said, no, you can't really do that. But it was an interesting exercise for him to go through. And knowing all the information that he knows about it.
I think the best way to learn about a very hot button topic is to take the side of that which you disagree with, because you will end up knowing more than those people, because they just assume, you know, what they, you're actually going to go in. Now you're going to have to argue on the basis of what facts you have. Might not be strong argument, but you're going to know more than they would.
I totally agree with you. In fact, when I was in debate in high school, that's one of the things that we should do to really master the topics that we were going to be debating. We would actually take the counterpoint and have to make that was what our coach used to make us do, take the counterpoint. So
Fascinating stuff here. But on the issue of MS, I've been lecturing on neurological degradation the last year plus now. More and more we learn about other things to help, including, of course, what you've done,
Robert,
over the years.
Yeah. Robert, I'm sorry. I hate to disturb you, interrupt you, but I just set you up to go into the autistic kid story, and you didn't do that. That's like the first time I've tried to set you up for an alley-oop, but you didn't slam it.
Well, the reason I didn't, and there is a good reason for this, because as I've read this story, and I was going to take you through that, the headline's not right, because it basically is, you know, when you send your kid to school and you get an exemption to not vaccinate, one of the things they make you do is somehow sign an acknowledgement that if there is an outbreak, your kid has to stay home, right?
Mm-hmm.
21 day, whatever it is. And so this story ends up being about a kid who had autism, who obviously is medically exempt, much less other reasons. And they said, no, you can't come to school. But that's not unique because he had or didn't have autism. It was just one of those general rules that says, well, this is what you agreed to. We have an outbreak. You can't come here. Now, of course, it's absurd because it's a chicken pox issue. And I'm thinking, man, get all the kids who haven't had it in there as soon as you can because you're going to help them. So there's a lot of absurdity to this article and the way it's presented as well.
I got you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, there was a good reason for that. So I will take that as a yes, you're paying attention, but you didn't get to read this article first, so I'm not going to even say anything more.
So what you're saying is that that was good that I was paying attention, but I really need to prepare beforehand and then pay attention in order to set you up right.
Exactly. And then we could go back and blame Super Don for picking out this article, but that's okay. No, it's a good discussion. Super D, we love you. Listen, I hear him. He's here. I'm in trouble now.
He's got us tuned out. He's not going to deal with us.
No. We got to talk to Dr. Sherry Tenpenny because that was off of Axter. So we'll talk about who wrote that. But regardless, the MS issue, I wanted to get back to that because we like to promote an idea that people can do something about it. And I want to talk about how to remyelinate. We're all up against the break, but things that we've encountered, including now things that are newer to us like CBD, other things that people that are at a risk because of their history, vaccines, heavy metals, etc. I want to throw out some ideas for folks, things that you've done, Dr. Bitar, that will help people if they're on the road to neurological degradation. If they're on a statin drug, they're definitely on that road. We'll talk about some strategies to get you off of that. How's that, Dr. Bitar? Are you up for that?
I'm up for it.
I think you are. Yeah, absolutely. Check it out. RobertScottBell.com. Take you to AdvancedMedicine.com. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of archives. They're still just as good as the day we did them live. Folks, a lot more healing to go. Stick with us.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
In all my years of radio, I've never seen anything like this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. In the health world through the power of radio. It's the Robert Scott Bell Show.
Remember, if you miss a little bit or a lot, you can go to GCNlive.com or Home and Broadcast Radio Syndication, and they have the audio up the first thing. And then iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, UK Health Radio. We have AdvancedMedicine.com. You used to go to MedicalRewind.com. All of those archives are there and now on YouTube. And Dr. Bitar, when he's able to, also puts it out on Facebook Live through his professional side, Dr. Rashide Bitar. So, Dr. Bitar, when we talk about neurological degradation, brain, nervous system, gut, all of that related, I don't know all of the factors that are causing, like those two teens, to get MS, but following closely after the HPV vaccine, which is a high aluminum-containing vaccine, never been tested for safety. Placebo control? No. Aluminum was in the placebo, right? This is a disaster to the brain and nervous system. It's another metal, like mercury. They all have unique attributes, but they're both very detrimental to brain and neurological health. Did we lose Dr. Bitar with no warning? Dude, really? Eric, see if you can get Dr. Bitar back on.
I'm not hearing anything. I'm like,
I had no idea. All right. Eric, see if you can get him back on. So let me just add this real quick before we get him back on here. You know, in terms of aluminum toxicity versus mercury toxicity, and Chris Barr, not a doc, you know, pointed this out the other day as well, and Dr. Chris Exley talked about this as well. In terms of aluminum toxicity, silicon or silica, key. In terms of mercury toxicity, selenium, key. These are minerals that are displaced and that can help to usher out the heavy metals. There are other things regarding antigens, the antigen response. They talk about these adjuvants like aluminum to aggravate immune response. So they cause hyperimmune responses that can lead to autoimmunity attack on what? The brain and neurological tissue. If the immune system begins to destroy the nerve cell, that can destroy the sheath surrounding the nerve cell, the myelin. And so why is it that doctors insist that it can't be possibly true that a vaccine could create such a mess when these adjuvants are designed intentionally to aggravate and hyperstimulate the immune response to hopefully develop an immune antibody response? But of course, it's leading people over the edge into hyperimmune responses where their own immune cells begin to attack cells of self. that have now been corrupted due to these very offensive elements, like these heavy metals, mercury, aluminum, but as well foreign RNA, DNA from animals, from aborted fetal cells, from animals, etc. So, anyway, Super Don, do we have Dr. Bitar back yet? It's a mystery how we lost him.
Not hearing anything, no. He's
Eric,
still live,
you trying
on,
to reach him?
Live on Facebook.
Yeah. Eric, you still trying to reach Dr. Bitar? Got a couple of minutes. I don't want to lose him out. I don't know where we... Do we lose Eric? Or is Eric just on the phone?
Eric? Trying. Are we talking to anybody other than ourselves right now?
We are
now,
still
right?
on the air. I can see. We're still connected. So I don't get any word back.
Right. Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's live radio for you.
Well, it is. It happens. So, Eric, see if you can get Dr. Bitar on. We've got about a couple of minutes left to wrap up with us here. And we'll see where we go. As far as other things that we utilize, some of you on YouTube have mentioned the nozodes. Homeopathic nozodes are basically homeopathic remedies made from the actual pathogen, if you call it that, virus, a bacteria, fungus. It's in a form that is not viable. It could never jump up and attack you. And through the process of serial dilution and succussion, it loses all toxicity, no danger. So in this case, you have the ability to stimulate the metabolic response energetically. For those of you who don't believe we're energetic beings, I got nothing for you. You're molecular reductionists. You don't believe in homeopathy. There's not a lot we can discuss. The only thing I would ask, and I think it's a sincere ask, and I think it's reasonable, is that you stay the hell out of my way. You get the hell out of anybody's way who wants to use it. You don't have to believe in it. You don't have to use it. But if you try to physically use force or violence or fraud to get the government to prohibit, and this is what's happening with the Fear and Death Administration, attacking homeopathy. Not because it's hurting anybody, because it can't, but because it's providing an option that certain folks on planet Earth, the skeptics and pharmaceutical allegiance, if you will, don't want you to have an option to choose anything but what they are providing by force, fraud, etc., through government agencies. All right, well, we'll get Dr. Bitar back on next week. Of course, the 11th is the big IADFW webinar, and we want you there. If you can't attend live, you've got to sign up so you can watch the recording of it, because you won't get it unless you sign up. So go to advancedmedicine.com. Your invitation code to join is 1358-1358. All right, with that, we'll be back tomorrow. Joni Abbott will be here on the Robert Scott Bell Show while I'm traveling. I appreciate y'all being here. Thanks, Dr. Bitar. Thanks, Super Don. Thanks, Eric. The power to heal is yours.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.